And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Get ready to the Old West, the most haunted city in the country. Well, I was contemplating last night. You know, I was doing a show on one of the local stations. And it was decided I wasn't liberal enough. Excuse me, I don't know what brought that on. So they told me I had to go away while they brought on another La Raza fan. And everything went to pot. Well, today's March the 20th. 79th. Well, as I said, I don't know what brought that on. I haven't had a sneezing fit like that in a while. Well, as I said, this is March 20th, 79th day of the year. 286 days remaining of the year is over with. Holidays and observances, which is what you all asked me to do. Now, believe it or not, with the world coming apart at the seams, this is International Day of Happiness. National Ravioli Day. National Macaroon Day. National Dogs and Yellow Day. International Data Center Day. French Language Day. World Storytelling Day. Hufflepuff Pride Day. National Proposal Day. Run out and propose today. National Kiss a Fiancé Day. Won't You Be My Neighbor Day. National Snowman Burning Day. Alien Abduction Day. Gotta have one of those. English Tourism Week. Neurodiversity Celebration Week. National Introverts Week. Ramadan. Still going on. March Madness. Famous people on this date. Fred Rogers. From Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. Michael Rappaport. And Chester Bennington. And it's also the Great Daffodil Appeal Month, National Reading Month, Veggie Month, National Sauce Month, National Peanut Month, National Colon Cancer Awareness Month, Epilepsy Awareness Month, Developmental Disability Awareness Month, Brain Tumor Awareness Month, National Women's History Month, National Nutrition Month, National Hemophilia Awareness Month, National Social Work Month, National Small Press Month, Multiple Sclerosis Awareness Month, National Caffeine Awareness Month, National Kidney Month, National Umbrella Month, National Craft Month, International Ideas Month, National Credit Education Month, National Cheerleading Safety Month, Endometriosis Awareness Month, Rising Star Month, Irish American History Month, National Music in Our Schools Month, and National Athletic Training Month. In 673 AD, Emperor Tenmu of Japan assumes the chrysanthemum throne in the palace of Kiyomihara in Asuka. 1206, Michael IV Odorianos is appointed ecumenical patriarch of Constantinople. And in 1600, an event took place that kind of put a spotlight on all the religious turmoil that was going on in the time period. The Linköping bloodbath took place on Maundy Thursday in Linköping, Sweden. Five Swedish noblemen were publicly beheaded in the aftermath of the war against Sigismund. And the war took place in 1598 and 1599. Now, for those that are not familiar with it, these five Swedish noblemen, their only crime, if you will, was how they chose to worship God. This public beheading resulted in a de facto deposition of the Polish and Swedish king Sigismund III Vasa as king of Sweden. They were advisors to Catholic Sigismund, or political opponents of the Sigismund's uncle and adversary, the Swedish regent Duke Charles. King Sigismund was the eldest son of King John III and inherited the crown from his father, and he was crowned the rightful king of Sweden. Now, he made a promise that he would not act to aid the Catholic cause in Sweden, but he violated that agreement, and that set off a civil war. And that's interesting. Everybody seems to worship the same God, but we're going to kill each other over how we do it. Makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? Well, in 1602, the Dutch East India Company is established. 1616, Sir Walter Raleigh is freed from the Tower of London after 13 years of imprisonment. Didn't even have cable TV. 1760, the Great Boston Fire of 1760 destroyed 349 buildings. It was one of the largest fires anybody could remember. The buildings were in the area between the modern Washington Street and Fort Hill that also destroyed several ships in port. More than 1,000 people were left homeless. Now, the town of Boston was repeatedly damaged by fire in its colonial history. There was a major fire in 1653, 1676, 1679, 1682, 1691, 1711, and 1753. Now, the term the Great Fire had previously been reserved for the fire of 1711, which had destroyed the first townhouse, but the 1760 fire proved to be larger and rendered 1711 as comparatively unimportant. As you can hear, the peanut gallery is tuning up. 1815, after escaping from Elba, Napoleon entered Paris with a regular army of 140,000 and a volunteer force of 200,000. This began what was known as the 100 Days Rule. 1848, German revolutions of 1848 and 1849, King Ludwig I of Bavaria abdicates. 1852, Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom Cabin is published. Like so many others, we had to read that when I was growing up in school. And I did a little bit of research, and while this was held up as the epitome of how evil slavery was, I found out Harriet Beecher Stowe had never been to the South. She made this whole thing up. 1854, the Republican Party of the U.S. is organized in Ripon, Wisconsin. 1861, an earthquake destroys Mendoza, Argentina. 1883, the Paris Convention for the Protection of Industrial Property is signed. 1888, the premiere of the very first Romani language operetta is staged in Moscow, Russia. The Romani language, for those that are not familiar. First, the Romin Theater in Moscow is the oldest, most famous of the Romani theaters in the world. And it's a key object of Romani culture in Russia. And from the moment it was founded in 1931, it's been a center of attraction for Romani artists in Russia. The Romani people are a distinct ethnic and cultural group of people living across the globe. It adheres to a shared language and sometimes traditional nomadic mode of life. The origin of the Romani people is unclear, but Central India is probable. If I'm not mistaken, it's what came to be known as the Gypsies. 1890, the Chancellor of the German Empire, Otto von Bismarck, is dismissed by Emperor Wilhelm II. 1896, with the approval of Emperor Gongzhu, the Wing Dynasty Post Office is open, marking the beginning of a postal service in China. 1913, Sun Chao-pien, the founder of the Chinese Nationalist Party, is wounded in an assassination attempt and dies 2 days later. 1916, Albert Einstein publishes his General Theory of Relativity. I heard somebody explain in a business environment what the theory of relativity was, which I found very enlightening. Those who are related to the powers that be move up faster than anybody else. And that's certainly quite true. 1921, Upper Silesia plebiscite was mandated by the Versailles Treaty to determine a section of the border between Weimar Germany and Poland. 1922, the USS Langley's commission is the first U.S. Navy aircraft carrier. 1923, the Art School of Chicago hosts the opening of Pablo Picasso's first U.S. showing. It's entitled Original Drawings by Pablo Picasso, becoming an early proponent of modern art in the U.S. 1926, Chiang Kai-shek initiates a purge of communist elements within the National Revolutionary Army in Guangzhou. 1933, Reichsführer SS Heinrich Himmler ordered the creation of Dachau concentration camp as chief of police of Munich and appointed Theodor Eich as the camp commandant. 1942, World War II, General Douglas MacArthur at Tarawi, South Australia, makes his famous speech regarding the fall of the Philippines, in which he says, "I came out of Bataan and I shall return." 1948, with the Musicians Union band lifted, the first telecast of classical music in the U.S. under Eugene Ormandy and Arturo Toscanini are given on CBS and NBC. 1951, Fujiwashita, city located in Yamanashi Prefecture, Japan, is the center of the Japanese main island of Honshu, is founded. 1952, the U.S. Senate ratifies a security treaty between U.S. and Japan. 1956, Tunisia gets independence from France. 1964, the precursor of the European Space Agency, ESRO, European Space Research Organization, is established by an agreement signed June 14, 1962. 1969, a United Arab Airlines, which is now Egypt Air, Aleutian 218, crashes at Aswan International Airport, killed 100 people. 1972, the Troubles. First car bombing by the Provisional IRA in Belfast killed 7 and injured 148 others in Northern Ireland. 1985, Libby Riddles becomes the first woman to win the 1,135-mile Iditarod Trail sled dog race. 1985, Canadian paraplegic athlete and humanitarian Rick Hansen begins his circumnavigation of the globe in a wheelchair in the name of spinal cord injury medical research. 1987, the Food and Drug Administration approves the anti-AIDS drug AZT on this date. 1988, the Eritrean War of Independence. Having defeated the Naidu command, the Eritrean People's Liberation Front entered the town of Afibet, victoriously concluding the Battle of Afibet. 1990, Ferdinand Marcos's widow, Imelda Marcos, goes on trial for bribery, embezzlement, and racketeering. 1993, the Troubles again. Provisional IRA bomb kills 2 children in Warrington, England. Leads to mass protests in both Britain and Ireland. 1995, the Japanese cult Aum Shinrikyo carries out a sarin gas attack on the Tokyo subway. Killed 13 and wounded over 6,200 others. 1999, Legoland, California, the first Legoland outside of Europe, opens in Carlsbad, California. On this date in the year 2000, Jameel Abdullah Al-Amin, the former Black Panther, once known as H-Rap Brown, is captured after murdering Georgia Sheriff Deputy Ricky Kinchin and critically wounding Deputy Algernon English. 2003 Iraq War. The U.S., the U.K., Australia, and Poland began an invasion of Iraq on this date. 2006, over 150 Chadian soldiers are killed in eastern Chad by members of the rebel UFDC. Rebel movement sought to overthrow Chadian President Idris Deby. 2010, Ejiofarlujökull in Iceland begins erupting, which will last for 3 months, heavily disrupting air travel in Europe. That long name that I probably butchered badly is a volcano. 2012, at least 52 people are killed and more than 250 injured in a wave of terror attacks across 10 cities in Iraq. 2014, 4 suspected Taliban members attacked the Kabul Serena Hotel, killing at least 9 people. 2015, a solar eclipse, equinox, and a supermoon all occur on the same day. Highly unusual. 2015, the Syrian Civil War. Siege of Kobani is broken by the People's Protection Units and Free Syrian Army, marking a turning point in the Rojava Islamist conflict. And in 2019, Kasym Jomart Tokayev is sworn in as acting president of Kazakhstan. This follows the resignation of longtime president Nursultan Nazarbayev. Sometimes people get in power and they just don't want to let it go. They get used to it. Well, we have finished our little history segment. You know, there's quite a bit of activity in the news right now. And I was asked to cover a little bit of it. The you know, the powers that be still will not give former President Trump any breathing room. Michael Cohen, the disgraced attorney, who made the, according to him, the payoffs to Stormy Daniels, is still popping up, screaming how evil Trump is. The we've got a, you know, spring break has been going on in Florida. And a lot of the spring break cities have tried to crack down to keep the carousing to a minimum. One couple was just found passed out on the beach, their children missing. The two 27-year-olds. Their kids, 5 and 7, just wandered off. Parents are unconscious. Kids were later found in a hotel swimming pool having a great time. The George Stephanopoulos had accused Trump of rape, and Trump is finally taking action. Thanks to our borders being inundated with immigrants, we've got a number of serious viral infections popping up that had long been eradicated in this country. Biden appears to be losing it. He is ranting and raving like something hadn't got good sense. The and rather than calmly addressing it, I think Biden's come pretty much to the end of his rope, because now he's swearing and carrying on. In his shout-out to Women's History Month, he forgot one of his granddaughters. Now, granted, that can happen when you got several, but This is not the first time he's appeared to forget what should be important things. You know, that's pretty much an overview of the news and what's going on in the world right now. We just caught a member of Hezbollah at the southern border. When I asked what he was doing, he said he's going to New York City to build a bomb. But, you know, our leaders say that's okay. He's a wonderful guy. He has every right to come here and build bombs. You just being racist by not wanting him to build bombs around you. Well, and today's political cartoon was the effing problem with the effing polls is being shouted by Joe Biden, and one of his people says, I'm really starting to miss this sympathetic, well-meaning, elderly man Robert Hur described. He was a special prosecutor that looked into the issue of the classified documents that Biden had stored in his garage. Now, Trump would have got the death penalty for that, but for Biden, he's well-meaning. He didn't mean to do anything wrong. We need legislators and judges who are not a member of any particular political party. These days, politics plays more and more important role than the law does, and that's sad. We're dealing with an issue just like that. You know, the contract over which we're fighting, it's absolutely impossible for us to have breached it. We couldn't do it if we wanted to. But friendly judges helping their friends who are attorneys for the plaintiffs, oh, yeah, we can find a way to have you breach it. Our rights don't mean anything because as a disabled veteran, according to the local city, we don't have any rights. As one person said, we're walking ATM machines. If they keep the pressure on us, we're going to spew money. Well, you know, when you're looking at crime, forensic science is a relatively new official science, but it's been centuries in the making. In 1813, Matthew Orfila published the first treatise that cataloged poisons and their effects. I mean, he actually should be known as the father of modern toxicology, although there wasn't such a thing even dreamed of in those days. He's one of the first to develop forensic blood tests, examining blood and semen with a microscope for forensic purposes. In 1835, Scotland Yard investigator Henry Goddard determined the butler had staged an attempted robbery when he traced a bullet back to a bullet mold owned by the butler. This was the first example of what you might call bullet matching, and one of the first actual recorded cases of the butler did it. The only thing that made it better is if the butler's name was Butler. 1863, a German scientist named Schönbein created the first presumptive test for blood when he discovered the hemoglobin oxidized hydrogen peroxide. So if you mix peroxide and ketchup, for example, you'll have inedible ketchup. If you mix what appears to be blood with hydrogen peroxide, it'll have a different reaction. 1880. In Tokyo, there was a burglary, and an innocent man was blamed for the theft. Scottish physician and missionary Henry Faulds used fingerprints in order to clear the accused, but also helped bring the actual criminal to justice. And he wrote about using fingerprints for crime solving in the Science Journal Nature, and then spent the next couple of decades in a letter writing spat with Sir William Herschel about which one of the two thought up the idea first. Now, this Sir William Herschel was not the Sir William Herschel who discovered Uranus. And in 1917, he eventually conceded that Henry Faulds had thought of it first. 1892, Sir Francis Galton of Great Britain published Fingerprints, first book to codify fingerprint patterns and show how to use them in solving crimes. Meanwhile, in Argentina, police investigator Juan Vucetich developed a fingerprinting classification system based on Galton's work and used it to accuse a mother of murdering her two sons and slitting her own throat to make it look like the work of somebody else. What gave her away? She left bloody fingerprints on a doorpost. Well, you can't think of everything when you're trying to commit the perfect crime. You just can't. Well, our next story comes from Logtown, which is an overgrown ghost town near Jacksonville, Oregon. Now, in 1861, it was a thriving mining town. But then Mary Hinkle and her two daughters, 6 and 16, were killed in a fire. Right away, the locals suspected it was more to this, just an accident. It was a triple murder. And the motive? Well, there was according to rumor, there was a hoard of gold hidden somewhere in Hinkle's cabin. During the investigation, a young photographer told police the last thing a person sees before death leaves an image on the retinas of the eyes. Now, photography was in its infancy, so the idea wasn't as strange as it might sound. So he set up his gear and took photos of the dead woman's eyes. Well, the photos were developed, and unfortunately, there was no image of a killer. In fact, nobody was ever formally charged with this crime. The young man was a Swiss immigrant named Peter Britt, going to become one of Oregon's most celebrated citizens. Not only started the grape industry in the Rogue Valley, he was also the first person to photograph what's now Crater Lake National Park. Today, the Brit Music Festival carries his name. Interestingly enough, cameras are not allowed at the venue from somebody who tried to pioneer photography. Oh, well. Well, let's talk about felons I'll tell you the stories and let you decide. We got Mark Mussarella, 46, of Staten Island, an emergency medical technician with the Richmond University Medical Center. He was called to an apartment where a 26-year-old woman had been murdered. Took a photo of the dead body with a cell phone and posted the photo on his Facebook page. Well, one of his friends saw the photo and called the hospital where he worked. He was immediately fired, and then he was arrested. Mussarella, a former highly decorated NYPD detective, also lost his EMT license. Can't win them all. Then we've got Paul Franco, who was 38, of Queens, New York. February 2010, he hacked the Facebook account of his ex-girlfriend, Jessica Zamora Anderson, changed her password and held the account hostage, demanded hundreds of dollars for the return of the account. Well, Zamora Anderson had met Franco 16 months before on Facebook. They started dating. She eventually found out he wasn't a teacher, but she kept dating him anyway because he claimed he had a tape of him having sex. And if she left him, he put it on the internet for sale. Well, he was arrested after the investigation. Zamora Anderson got her Facebook account back. And it turns out he really didn't have a sex tape. Well, let's talk about a bizarre lawsuit. The plaintiffs were the Cherry Sisters, an Iowa singing group. The defendant was the Des Moines Register. And it was a landmark libel case. Turn of the century, the Register ran a scathing review of the Cherry Sisters Act. According to the reporter, their long, skinny arms, equipped with talons at the extremities, waved frantically at the suffering audience. The mouths of their rancid features opened like caverns, and sounds like the wailing of the damned souls issued therefrom. Well, outraged and humiliated, the singer sued the newspaper and the writer for libel. Well, to arrive at a proper decision, the judge asked the sisters to perform their act for him in court. After he heard him out, he ruled in favor of the newspaper. Oh, well. How about Rob Kropinski, 36-year-old Philadelphia real estate manager? The defendant was a Transcendental Meditation Society and Guru Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. Well, Kropinski had worked for the Transcendental Meditation Society for 11 years, but he finally sued him because he was never able to achieve the perfect state of life they promised, and as a result, he suffered psychological disorders. One of the broken agreements that he alleged was he'd been told he'd be taught to fly through self-levitation. But he learned only to hop with the legs folded in the lotus position, which was quite a talent, I have to say. Well, the U.S. District Court in Washington, D.C., which is not known for its logic, frankly, gave him nearly $138,000 in damages. According to them, a promise is a promise. Now, let's talk about the case of the disappearing judge. I'm talking about Judge Joseph Crater, newly appointed justice of the New York Supreme Court and a potential appointee to the U.S. Supreme Court. Crater and his wife were vacationing in Maine on August 3rd, 1930. He got a phone call from New York City. After he finished the call, he told his wife he had to go straighten those fellas out. So he left her on vacation and he went back to New York City. 9 days later, when the wife hadn't heard from him, she notified the police and massive manhunt began. Well, police searched the apartment of the Craters and didn't find anything suspicious. But as the investigation continued, the police and the public were shocked to see Crater's carefully constructed facade unravel. Turned out he'd kept a number of mistresses and been seen around town with showgirls. And most surprising of all was his involvement in graft, fraud, and political payoffs. Also seemed as though he'd been implicated in the Ewald scandal, which involved paying for a city appointment. And there was evidence he had actually paid for his own appointment to the bench. Well, some folks were sure he was murdered by gangster associates, and others, noting the judge had removed files containing potentially criminal evidence from his office just before he disappeared, speculated political cronies had killed him to shut him up. Maybe the judge committed suicide rather than watch his career crumble because of scandal. But whatever may have been the outcome, everyone assumed Crater was dead. Well, his wife suffered a nervous breakdown and didn't come back to their New York apartment until January 1931. When she did, she found an envelope in the top drawer of her dresser. It contained $6,690 in cash and a judge's will written 5 years before. Left his entire estate to her. And it was a 3-page pencil note that listed everybody who owed the judge money. The last line said, "I'm very weary. Love, Joe." Police searched the apartment thoroughly and kept a 24-hour guard on it since he had disappeared. So nobody had the faintest clue as to how that envelope got in that drawer. There was another possibility that Crater had intentionally disappeared. Whatever may have been the truth of the matter, in July of 1937, Crater was declared legally dead and his wife collected his life insurance. By that point in time, New York police commissioners believed Crater's disappearance was premeditated. There were several stories from the Old West of prospectors running into a guy leading a burro who introduced himself as Judge Crater. Well, another interesting point of fact. During the Middle Ages, murdering a traveling musician was not considered a serious crime because they were a pain in the rear to everybody. Well, let's talk about some strange outcomes of court cases. 1986 court case didn't go well for Otis Elevator Company. Might have had something to do with the fact that the jury on their way to hear the case got stuck for 20 minutes in an Otis elevator. I'd be kind of PO'd at them, too. Similar thing happened to Pacific Gas and Electric Company in 2000. While on trial for failure to trim vegetation around power lines, Blanche fell off a tree and knocked out power in the courthouse for a couple of hours. 1992, the Postal Service was defending itself against an unemployment discrimination lawsuit. In order to proceed, the defense had to mail a list of expert witnesses from Washington, D.C. to Dayton, Ohio. The list was sent via the Postal Service's overnight express mail delivery service. But it took 10 days to arrive in Dayton. Well, the production company won a $1.8 million judgment against a former employee accused of stealing the concept for a television game show. The stolen show was entitled Anything for Money. And to many people, that's how it is. Well, there's a lot of stories that come out of prisons. Let's talk about the prisoner who spent the most time on Alcatraz Island in the San Francisco Bay. He was actually a Canadian, Alvin Old Creepy Carpus, born in Montreal in 1908. Well, by his 10th birthday, he had fallen in with a bad crowd that corrupted his morals, assuming he had any to begin with. He was first arrested for burglary in 1926. Got hired into an entry-level position in the murderous Barker Gang and worked his way up the ladder to an upper management position, increasing gang profits by innovating a successful strategy of kidnapping industrialists for ransom. Among the victims were William Ham Jr., the Ham Brewing Company. That got him $100,000, the equivalent of $1.5 million a day. Edward Bremer, president of a Minnesota bank, he was worth $200,000 in ransom, which would be about $3 million a day. And as proof of his commitment to the organization, Carpus had his fingerprints surgically removed so he couldn't be traced. Well, United States bureaucrats caught him anyway and arrested him in 1936, sent him briefly to Leavenworth Prison in Kansas, and finally to Alcatraz. Well, when Alcatraz was closed in 1962, Carpus, who was still living, was transferred to McNeil Island Penitentiary in Washington, where he taught a young Charles Manson how to play the guitar. Carpus referred to Manson as lazy and shiftless. 1969, he was deported to Canada, which is where he was born, as I said. He died in 1979. Maybe. Couldn't prove it by the fingerprints. He didn't have any. Well, let's talk about a police scandal. This one's referred to as the Rampart Scandal. It involved dozens of Los Angeles police officers. Well, Rafael Perez was an officer of the LAPD's Rampart Division, also a member of Community Resources Against Street Hoodlums, or CRASH. It was an elite LAPD anti-gang unit. 1998, Perez was arrested for stealing 6 pounds of cocaine from an evidence room. He was given a 5-year sentence and immunity in exchange for testimony against fellow officers. Well, Perez agreed. He thought that was probably a good deal. Gave more than 4,000 pages of testimony implicating dozens of his fellow crash officers in drug deals, murder, robbery, perjury, falsification of police reports, extortion, and more. Of the 70 officers he implicated, 7 resigned, 12 were suspended, and 5 were fired. Only 7 were tried on criminal charges, and 3 of those were convicted. But their convictions were later overturned. But the city of Los Angeles ended up paying over $125 million to settle more than 140 civil suits against the city. In 2000, the crash unit was closed down for good. The investigation found that at least 3 crash officers were on the payroll of hip-hop mogul Marion Suge Knight and his label Death Row Records. 2007, Perez and 2 other Rampart officers were named in a wrongful death lawsuit. It was alleged they had carried out the drive-by murder of the rapper Notorious B.I.G. That lawsuit was dismissed in 2010, and that the murder of Notorious B.I.G. has never been solved. Well, one thing that's come to eminently clear when you read all the stuff about organized crime, in the world of organized crime, you can't trust nobody. I'm going to give you an example. Joe the Boss Masseria was an old line Sicilian mob boss whose ultimate goal was to become head of the mafia in New York. Well, not sharing Masseria's dream, though, were younger family members such as Lucky Luciano and Vito Genovese. They wanted him out of the picture, as did mobsters such as Lepke Bill Coulter and Oney Madden. When another rival mobster, Salvatore Maranzano, began to encroach on Masseria's businesses, Joe the Boss took a hard line and fought back. This was the beginning of a power struggle that became known as the Castello Maurice War, during which more than 60 men on both sides were killed. Luciano and Genovese secretly contracted Maranzano, I can't talk, and offered him a deal. If he had stopped the bloodshed, they'd kill Masseria. Maranzano agreed. April 15, 1931, Luciano invited Joe the Boss to the Nuevo Villa Tamaro restaurant, a spaghetti house on Coney Island. They ate spaghetti, played some cards, and Luciano got up and went to the bathroom. While Luciano was in the bathroom, 2 men strolled into the restaurant, fired 20 shots into Masseria, and strolled out again. After that, Luciano took over Masseria's crime family. The Nuevo Villa Tamaro's owner, an Italian immigrant named Gerardo Scarpato, shut down the restaurant and moved back to Italy. 6 months later, he came back to New York and was murdered. Nobody was ever accused or convicted. He may have known more than it was good for him. Well, it's long been said, judge not, lest ye be judged. Douglas County Judge Richard Jones was suspended by the Nebraska Supreme Court after an investigation into 17 complaints concerning his conduct. He had taken to signing court documents with names like A. Hitler and Snow White and setting bail amounts in imaginary currencies. He was also accused of urinating on the courthouse carpets, making an anonymous death threat against another judge. He said it was just a prank that went wrong, and throwing firecrackers into that same judge's office. Well, he contested a number of the charges, but admitted he did throw the firecrackers. He said, I was venting. Don't want anybody to think he was going off on him, so to speak. Well, dogged by a state investigation into claims he was abusive to defendants, Judge Fred Heen announced that he would not seek re-election. Well, there were a few interesting examples of the conduct he was accused of. A woman convicted of a traffic violation asked for more time to complete her community service because she'd been bedridden on doctor's orders during the final weeks of her pregnancy. Judge denied her request and sentenced her to 44 days in jail. When she protested she had a 7-day-old baby at home, the judge said, "Ma'am, you should have thought about that a long time ago." Judges like that don't need to be on the bench. I got 3 or 4 names here I could give you that shouldn't be on the bench. Well, you know, there are some odd and outlandish thieves out there. Like the ones that dressed up as priests. Police in Serbia, 3 men disguised as Orthodox Christian priests, complete with fake beards and ankle-length cassocks, went into a bank, gave the traditional Christ is born greeting, pulled out shotguns, and stole more than $300,000. Some other bandits dressed up as cops. On the night of March 8, 1990, 2 men disguised as cops knocked on the door of the prestigious Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston. Security guards on duty let them in and were immediately overpowered by the thieves. Made off of several paintings, a Vermeer, a Manet, 3 Rembrandts, worth about $300 million. Still ranks as the largest art theft in U.S. history, and it's never been solved. Then we've got some odd thieves who dressed up as a pair of underwear. Police in Canada announced in 2004 they'd finally caught the Black Panties Bandit, who'd lobbed at least 5 convenience stores while wearing a pair of black pair of women's underwear over his face as a disguise. It takes all kinds to make a whirl. Well, let's talk about the police blotter. February 21st, 2012, a man attempted to trick the employees of a Denny's restaurant in Madison, Wisconsin. According to the police report, it was 4:32 in the afternoon. James B. Summers, who was 52 from Madison, was arrested for fraud, disorderly conduct, possession of drug paraphernalia, and possession of an electric weapon. The victim was female, 38 years old. Now, he never announced he's one of the pros from Dover, but the briefcase-toting gentleman wearing a maroon tie and long black trench coat was quite clear. He'd been sent by corporate. Claimed he was the new general manager. He'd worked for the restaurant chain for 30 years, and he was starting his new job right now. Well, the existing manager was in the process of counting the day's receipts at the Denny's on Thierry Road. Heard nothing from corporate about a new general manager. He said it was fine or he was going to start his duties right then. It was this point the manager started making calls up the food chain, so to speak. She was able to reach the man in charge of all hiring at her location. Well, unfortunately, by this point in time, the new general manager left the office, but not the restaurant. And she'd shut the office door to carry out her private conversations. Well, while on the phone, she waved off kitchen staff as they rapped on her door trying to get her attention. But she was not to be interrupted while talking with corporate. What the staff was trying to tell her was that the new general manager was cooking a cheeseburger and fries for himself and has gotten himself a Coke. He's in the midst of dining when she let him know the gig was up. She'd talked to corporate and he was no new hire. Then she called 911. When responding officers arrived, they saw the suspect walking away from the restaurant. Upon contact, he told the officer it was a misunderstanding. He was the new general manager, but that there must have been a paperwork foul up. Well, the existing manager prevailed. The man was arrested. Officers found underneath that man's trench coat and suit coat, he was packing a stun gun. They asked if the suspect had a concealed carry permit, and he said it's in the pipeline. He was cooperative with the officers, but as he was being led away from the restaurant, he yelled out at all those sitting there eating, "This is why you don't dine and dash, kids. You might get in trouble." Well, you know, we've talked about some dumb criminals in some of our previous shows, but let's talk about dumb crooks of the Old West. I'm talking about Coffeyville, Kansas. The year was 1890. Bob Emmett and Grattan Dalton, along with 2 other men, formed a gang of outlaws. And they were looking for that big payoff and the fame that goes with it. And they thought that could only come from the major, legendary bank heist. And they planned it all out, every single step. Well, the Daltons aimed to rob two banks at once. Two men would rob the First National Bank. The other three would hit Condon and Company across the street. Thought they'd get double the return for their efforts, but they only doubled their chances of getting caught. Instead of traveling to another town where nobody knew them, they chose Coffeyville, where everybody knew them. The street in front of the banks was being repaired the day of the heist. They could have postponed it, but they went ahead anyway. They actually had to tie up their horses a block away, which made the getaway a little difficult. And they wore disguises. But the disguises were wispy stage mustaches and goatees. Well, the townspeople saw the Dalton boys coming and armed themselves. The Daltons did get $20,000 from First National, but came up empty at the other bank. And as they ran out to head for their horses, an angry mob was waiting for them in the street. And a hail of bullets came their way. Killed every member of the gang except Emmett Dalton, and went to prison. He came out from the penitentiary to discover the Dalton gang's story had been immortalized. They weren't immortalized as legendary outlaws. They were immortalized as hapless screw-ups. But as Popeye once said, you can't fit them all. You know, in the early 1990s, Pablo Escobar became the richest known criminal in the world. He was making $1 million a day, providing the U.S. with 80% of its cocaine. Eventually, he wound up going the way of most criminals. And finally, 2007, a professional arm wrestler named Arsene Lelieve tried to qualify for a lower and easier weight class at a European tournament by sending a lookalike to weigh in. Well, he was caught when officials noticed his lookalike didn't look anything like him. Oh, well. July 2007, Florida passed a law that made it a crime to be a fake band. Singing groups from the 50s and 60s were touring the casino in elderly, heavy state, but people who paid to see the Drifters, for example, were really watching a band with one or two replacement members and a bunch of hired singers. The legislation was introduced by Jim Bowser Bauman of the group Sha-Na-Na, which made a career out of singing other people's hits. Gotta wonder sometimes. Then Molly Bristar, secretary at the Catholic Diocese of Arlington, Virginia, put fake names on her employer's payroll and issued checks to herself. Then she used the money to fly to another state. She went to Utah, where she charged dental work and cosmetic surgery to the diocese. So you have to ask yourself, why would doctors allow Bristar to charge her services to the church? Well, very simply, she dressed up as a nun. When asked why she didn't quit when she was ahead, she said it became a habit. Da-da-da-da. On that note, we come to the end of today's show. We'll be back tomorrow. And once again, you'll be listening to Ken Hudnall and the Ken Hudnall Show. Until then, have a truly great evening.